compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
A little Andrew Cuomo news for you. You may remember him, the disgraced former governor of New York, huge abortion proponent, by the way. But he had to step away from his office because of many allegations about him doing immoral things. Well, it's being reported in the last few days that he's been ordered by a court to return $5.1 million in his book profits. He wrote a book about his role in the pandemic and all the allegedly great things he was doing to fight against the pandemic. Well, New York's top ethics panel on Tuesday ordered the disgraced ex-governor Andrew Cuomo to pay the state $5.1 million in book profits that he made on the backs of taxpayers amid the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic. The extraordinary resolution was approved by the Joint Commission on Public Ethics in a 12-1 vote a month after the ethics agency voted to revoke its prior approval, allowing Cuomo to earn outside income from his book American Crisis while he was still governor and New York was in the throes of the deadly coronavirus outbreak. The lone dissenter, oddly enough, was William Fisher, a Cuomo appointee. The resolution drafted by Commissioner David McNamara, a state Republican appointee, said Cuomo now lacked the legal authority to engage in outside activity and receive compensation in regard to the book. Governor Cuomo is not legally entitled to retain compensation for any form of outside activity related to the book. So anyway, so 12-1 they voted and it passed. So he's going to have to fork over $5.1 million. If you're interested in the story, I retweeted it on Twitter just a couple of days ago. It's been out for a couple of days. So something to keep in mind if you're interested in that story. Also, I have a little tidbit here. This is cool. The audio is not quite good enough for us to be able to play it on the air, but I think you'll be edified by seeing this. This is from ABC News. A man from a few towns away traveled with his grill and a truckload of food to give out free food to the people of Mayfield, Kentucky, which, as you know, was wiped off the map. It's just completely obliterated by the tornadoes last week. And you can hear him. He says he was born in Paducah, and he lives a ways away, but he doesn't have a restaurant. He doesn't do anything in the food business, but he wanted to help people, and he's standing there in the midst of this utter devastation. There's just rubble left where this town was once standing. And so he's talking about how he thought, you know, this is the right thing to do. People are hungry. We have first responders here. People are, you know, they don't have homes anymore. So he brought down hamburgers, chicken, sausages, eggs. And this is all free on him. And he's just a regular guy. And I think that's cool. And I'd like to see more of that kind of thing. So if you're interested, you'll see it on my Twitter feed at Patrick Madrid. Now, before we go to the phones, we have an abortion pill update. This is from the New York Times. The FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, has moved to permanently allow abortion pills by mail. The decision will broaden access to medication abortion, an increasingly common method. And the federal government said Tuesday of this week that it has permanently lifted a major restriction on access to abortion pills. It will allow patients to receive the medication by mail instead of requiring them to obtain the pills in person from specially certified health providers. Now, you realize why this is happening. Of course, it's happening because Roe versus Wade is teetering on the brink. And the Supreme Court, which has heard the case that we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, it heard the case a couple of weeks ago, and will issue its decision on this abortion-related topic. This has to do with the laws prohibiting abortion after a heartbeat is detected, and it would effectively eliminate Roe versus Wade if it goes in the right direction. So referring to this particular lawsuit that's in place right now, the decision was made by the Food and Drug Administration, to get ahead of this so that even if the Supreme Court does overturn Roe versus Wade, may it please happen, they will make sure that you can still get your abortion pills by mail. So the evil one is working overtime in defense of abortion. And the sad and sick thing about this whole issue, and you can read the whole article if you're interested, Cyrus will get it posted for you. The sad and sick thing about this whole thing is that these people who are implacably relentlessly doing everything they possibly can, tooth and nail, fighting to be able to keep abortion available, they think that they're doing the right thing. They think they wrap themselves falsely in the mantle of self-righteousness. They think they're the moral ones. They think they're defending human freedom. That's what's so twisted about this whole thing, that the very people who are the architects of death and destruction through abortion and those who are their foot soldiers and minions, if you're pro-life, they think you are the problem, that you're the one who's standing up in defense of unborn life. They think you are the one who is immoral. So they're going to connive and twist and do somersaults and backflips and gyrate every way they possibly can to make sure that those abortions can continue. And I'm sure the evil one is very pleased with their work. But we shall overcome. Right, Cyrus? We shall overcome.
Oh, man. It just, I really don't understand it. And there's never, I never hear any talk about the damage that this has to, from the left, when I'm watching a show and it's like all about how the woman is liberated from having an abortion and now she can get to her career and get to her real life instead of being bogged down with the problem of raising a child.
Didn't President Obama say, "I don't want my daughter punished with a baby"?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And but they never talk about the psychological damage that lasts forever.
Well, because A, that's an inconvenient truth, and B, in some cases, they don't even believe it. You know, they think that getting an abortion is something to celebrate. It's a disgusting thing, but that's the latest twist in this story. I do have a couple quick vaccine updates I'll get to in a minute. First, though, some phone calls. Let's go to Nancy waiting patiently in Minnesota. Good morning, Nancy.
I'm sorry, is that me?
Yes. Hi, Nancy. Welcome.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, a friend of mine asked me a question that I couldn't answer. What happens to a teenager who has bad cancer and who dies, but was never baptized?
Well, baptism is necessary for salvation. So without baptism, one cannot go to heaven, because in order to be in heaven, you have to have sanctifying grace. And baptism is what gives the soul sanctifying grace. So what the church says is that in the case of somebody who dies without baptism, now normally this question revolves around infants or children who are aborted or who miscarry, but we could apply the same discussion to a teenager. The church says that, strictly speaking, without baptism, you cannot be saved. So God has, of course, the freedom to give sanctifying grace to whomever he wishes, however he wishes to do so. So the church recognizes that there may in fact be situations where God does give sanctifying grace in a way that we don't know about. So the church says we should pray for God's mercy for those who die without the benefit of baptism. So it would be a very good thing to continue praying for the repose of the soul of that teenager. And it's possible that in his final moments or at some point before he died, that even in his heart, without receiving the sacrament of baptism, he accepted the Lord's offer of forgiveness and salvation, and he repented of his sins, and he believed in God, all these things being necessary. Those things may have happened, and you can consider the good thief on the cross who was saved, and he was not baptized. There was no opportunity for him to be baptized, and yet he was saved. So the church says hope and pray and ask the Lord to give him salvation. And beyond that, there's not much more that we can say. We just have to hope in God's mercy. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I know it's a sad story, but hopefully that brings some comfort to people. How about now, Lori in La Crosse, Wisconsin? Good morning, Lori.
Good morning. I have a question. I am a nurse in a family practice clinic, and one of my jobs is to administer contraceptive injections.
Mm-hmm. Depo-Provera?
Am I wrong doing that? That's exactly what it is, yes.
Yeah, that would be immoral. Mm-hmm. Because then you're directly participating in an immoral act. And so that would be where you'd have to say, "I'm sorry, I can't do that."
Okay.
I don't know if they'll reassign you, but
yeah.
Now, have you been doing that?
I have been, yes. Mm-hmm. It really only recently occurred to me that mm-hmm. I probably shouldn't be.
Yeah.
We actually got a provider who will not prescribe birth control.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, my goodness. And she's Catholic. I'm like, yeah. Well, if she doesn't prescribe it, I shouldn't be giving it. But right. I just wanted to check.
Yeah, so you've been unsure about this, obviously, and in your lack of clarity, you realize that there's something wrong with it. You didn't quite know what it was. But my advice would be when you go to confession the next time, bring this up and just say, you know, for the last X number of months or years, I have given this injection X number of times, as far as I can tell. And I realize now much more clearly the problem here. So even though I was a bit hazy on it before, I realized that it was wrong and I just want to confess it. And then it's done. You've left it at the foot of the cross. And you know that it's been forgiven.
And then at work, I can just say I can't do that.
Yes.
What I should do is, okay.
Let me share with you. So when you hang up, please keep listening, and I'll share with you some medical information about the Depo-Provera shot and what it does to the body and why there's a problem with it. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Lori. Important question she's asking. So this is courtesy of Catholic News Agency, What a Woman Should Know About Contraceptives. Now, with regard to the Depo-Provera shot, so commonly known as the shot, Depo-Provera, a long-acting progestin hormone, is injected into a woman's muscle every 3 months. It works by decreasing ovulation, by inhibiting sperm transport, and by changing the lining of a woman's uterus. Norplant is another progestin that is placed into a silastic, that's a rubber-like tube, and placed under the skin of a woman and left there for up to 5 years. So both in the case of Norplant and Depo-Provera, here are the ethical problems. By changing the lining of the uterus, both can cause an early abortion when conception does occur. Women who use Norplant will probably experience more than one abortion each year, since the average woman ovulates in more than 40% of her cycles while using Norplant. Depo-Provera may theoretically cause just as many abortions as Norplant, since it is also a type of progestin. And it gives a series of the medical side effects that are involved in women who take the Depo-Provera shot. A few examples. The results of two major worldwide studies have shown that women who take Depo-Provera for 2 years or more before age 25 have at least 190% increased risk of developing breast cancer. In addition, Depo-Provera may reduce a woman's bone density and worsen a woman's cholesterol level. One study found that women who had received injectable progestins, such as Depo-Provera, for at least 5 years and who had used them at least 5 years prior suffered a 430% increase in risk of developing cervical cancer. Let me repeat that. For getting the Depo-Provera shot, and they do give, you know, some specifics here. If you've been getting the Depo-Provera shot for 5 years or more, you have a 430% higher risk of developing cervical cancer, and you have a nearly 200% higher risk of developing breast cancer. Several studies have shown that women who receive injectable progestins have a much higher rate of contracting the AIDS virus if their partner is infected, with one study showing a 240% increased risk of contracting the AIDS virus. Let's see. I'll leave it at that. There's no need to kind of keep going, but I will tell you that it's not only morally wrong, but in terms of the damage that it does to the woman's body and the heightened risk for these terrible and often lethal diseases, it's just a wonder to me that any woman would ever accept it. It just boggles my mind. And Cyrus will get a link to this article from the CNA so that if you're interested in reading it or maybe sharing it with people in your life, with women in your life, I should say, because you want them to know about the risks, we'll get this article posted for you so you can check it out for yourselves. 888-914-9149. How about Elena in Orlando, Florida? Good morning, Elena.
Good morning. Patrick, my question kind of needs a little bit of background story to go with it first. So I'm Catholic.
Okay.
I was raised in the Methodist Church kind of loosely, and so was my sister. And she was baptized in the Methodist faith.
Okay.
My sister went through a period of atheism during her teen years and early 30s, but within the last year or so, she has started coming back into the faith, into the Christian faith, and she's actually chosen to go into the Orthodox Christian faith. She listens to a lot of Dr. Jordan Peterson and Jonathan Pageau. Jonathan Pageau is Orthodox, I believe he's from Canada. But she's been going to the Antiochian Orthodox Church, and this Saturday she is going to go to be baptized in this Antiochian Orthodox Church. And I am concerned, and I've brought my concerns to her, because she was baptized as a Methodist with water in the Trinitarian formula.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I can understand, and I have read about this, that should be, that's a valid baptism, that she should not be getting baptized again or rebaptized. And I don't know if you have any perspective on that or can offer me any insight.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly true that if you have been already validly baptized, that you cannot be baptized again. It doesn't mean that you may not be baptized again, because people do this, but it's not a real baptism. It doesn't actually do anything. And for those who know better, that would actually be a sin to get rebaptized, because it would be, a denial of the fact that a valid baptism actually accomplishes what it symbolizes. So perhaps she's ignorant of that. Perhaps the Antiochian Orthodox Church that she's attending now, maybe they had sufficient reason to doubt the validity of the first baptism. Maybe there's no baptismal certificate. That's possible. And they may say that without a baptismal certificate, we can't know for sure. So it might be that they're conditionally baptizing her because there's some doubt. The Eastern Orthodox recognize, as we do, of course, that baptisms validly conferred cannot be repeated. So it would surprise me if they said, well, we're just going to baptize you anyway, because even though you were validly baptized there, we're not going to really count that. It would surprise me to no end if they're, the people making these decisions were that theologically ignorant, and I don't think they would be. So my assumption is it's probably because there's some reason to doubt the validity of that sacrament. That's, I think, why they'd be taking the step. And I think I also didn't go back to you. There we go. There you are, Elena. Sorry about that.
Okay. No worries. All right. So then if I attended this baptism, would I be putting myself at any risk of, being in a state of mortal sin,
no,
knowing that I know that she was, okay.
No, now you say she was raised Methodist, right? She was never a Catholic. Is that right?
Right. She was never a Catholic. We were loosely raised Methodist. We were both baptized. I converted in my 20s to Catholicism. And she's, just like I said, has been kind of on this atheist journey and finally come full circle and back to
God
Christianity,
bless her,
and has chosen Orthodoxy. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So she's gone this route. And I just don't know. I'm fully supportive of her going, to the Orthodox Church. And I just wanted to find out if it was necessary for her to be baptized in the Orthodox Church, given the fact that she was already baptized, and two, if it would be, if it's something I should not participate in as far as going to her baptism.
No, I don't think you have any worries there, because it's obviously going to be a valid baptism, presuming, of course, that, if she's being baptized conditionally, then it's not an actual baptism. But if there's some question, some doubt, then they're right to do this if that's the reason for it. But although the Eastern Orthodox churches, they live apart from the Catholic Church that they broke away from, we still recognize their valid holy orders and their valid sacraments. So in a case like this, where she was a Protestant, now she's Orthodox, there's no reason to prevent you from going and celebrating with her. It's a good thing. It's a great day. And you could be very happy for her. Would that she became Catholic, or maybe eventually she will become Catholic, but only God knows. But at the very least, she will be entering into a church that does have valid sacraments. So we can rejoice in that.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. If you're interested in any background on this issue, I would recommend a book by James Likudis. His last name is Likoudis. He wrote a book called Ending the Byzantine Greek Schism. And he himself was raised Greek Orthodox and lived as a Greek Orthodox believer for quite some time. Eventually, he became Catholic. And in this book, Ending the Byzantine Greek Schism, he explains in this book format to his friends and relatives and anyone who might be interested why he recognized that he needed to become Catholic and why he wound up leaving the Greek Orthodox Church and becoming Catholic. And his reasons, I think, are very cogent. So if you're looking for some background on some of the distinctives and issues in play, that would be a good book that I think you'd like. Thank you. Break time. We're going to do that now, and we'll come back with more. I promised you I'd give you just a quick vaccine update. I know you have vaccine fatigue, but there are two new stories that just came out in the last 24 hours that I think you need to know about. I'll tell them to you quickly, and then we'll get back to your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh. All the fields we go, laughing all the way. Bells on bobtail ring.
Relevant Radio accepts donations of unwanted vehicles. The process is easy, free, and helps keep Relevant Radio rolling. More information at 888-906-9069 or relevantradio.com.
Real life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
You might get a chuckle out of this one. This is on the Daily Wire. In response to Senator Elizabeth Warren's accusation of freeloading, Elon Musk responded to her. This is great. This is like a Twitter duel, and it didn't last very long, and Elizabeth Warren didn't win it. So Elizabeth Warren tweeted a picture of Elon Musk, and she says, "Let's change the rigged tax code so the person of the year," referring to Musk, "will actually pay taxes and stop freeloading off everyone else." And so he tweeted right back to her. He says, "And if you opened your eyes for 2 seconds, you would realize I will pay more taxes than any American in history this year." Followed up with, "Don't spend it all in one place. Oh, wait, you did that already." In response to the same thread, Musk shared an article referencing Warren's lies about being Native American alongside the tweet, "Stop projecting." He says, "You remind me of when I was a kid and my friend's angry mom would just randomly yell at everyone for no reason." Anyway, so this is kind of cute. He is paying, let's see, it gets into the specifics of how much he's going to pay. And I think his tax bill this year, this is his personal tax bill this year, will be about $10 billion.
Whoa.
Serious question for you, Cyrus. Have you ever paid $10 billion in any given year on your taxes?
Add up all the years I will ever live, times it by 100.
Times a trillion?
Right. No.
No, not even once?
Not even once.
Yeah. So I think this is funny. It's almost like she didn't do any research before she made that tweet. But to her credit, she didn't delete it. It's still up there. So anyway, I thought that was funny. Now, not so funny on the issue of the vaccine. The New York Times is reporting that the vast majority of active duty troops in the Army and Navy are vaccinated against the coronavirus. It's not a vaccine, my friend will say. Okay. And the small number of those still refusing the shots will soon be dismissed from the military. In the Army, 468,459 active duty soldiers, that's 98%, have received at least one dose of the vaccine. The Navy has given shots to 343,000 members, roughly 1.7% still holding out. Some of those who are unvaccinated, however, have medical and administrative waivers or pending requests or have already signed up for the shots. But Army officials said that about 1% or fewer of active force members are in that category. Thousands of troops requested religious exemptions. None have been granted. The National Guard's vaccination numbers have lagged behind the rest of the military. The holdouts, especially among National Guard troops, underscore the increasing politicization of vaccine mandates in a part of government, the military, where many other vaccinations are administered with little controversy. The Senate passed final legislation this week that would prohibit the service branches from dishonorably discharging any member who refused to get the coronavirus vaccine. The measure, which was supported by Republicans in the House and Senate, allows those who decline the vaccine to receive certain benefits after leaving the military. On Thursday, right after the three branches of the military released their latest vaccine numbers after passing a deadline for troops to be inoculated, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas made public a letter he sent to the Pentagon that said the state would not impose a vaccine mandate on members of its National Guard. He wrote, "As governor of Texas, I am the commander-in-chief of this state's militia. If the federal government keeps threatening to defund the Texas National Guard, I will deploy every legal tool available to me as governor in defense of these American heroes." And so on and so forth. So within a matter, it seems, of weeks, the people who are in the military who are not going to get vaccinated will be purged. Now, in a related story, this from the Daily Wire, over 120 airmen at March Air Force Base, it's now March Air Reserve Base, just outside of Riverside, California, including their chaplain, have been denied religious exemptions to the COVID-19 vaccine mandate, according to the base's public information officer. The Air Force recognizes chaplains as one of the most important individuals in determining religious exemptions. Air Education and Training Command Public Affairs Captain Allison Kirk clarified the chaplain's significance, saying, "For airmen seeking a religious accommodation request, chaplains play a critical role in ensuring each request is fully considered in accordance with the, you know, a bunch of letters and numbers here, religious freedom in the Department of the Air Force. Exemptions are determined through a religious accommodation request. Certain laws, like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, require the government to offer a significant reason for encroaching on religious beliefs. The RFRA Act, introduced by Democrat of New York Senator Chuck Schumer when he was representative for the ninth District, bars the government from substantially burdening a person's religious freedom without compelling government interest. According to U.S. Air Force policy, religious accommodations for sincerely held religious beliefs are denied if they present a real adverse impact on military readiness, unit cohesion, good order, discipline, and health or safety. This week, the Air Force was the first to reportedly discharge service members for refusing the COVID-19 vaccine. In this case, 27 airmen. None of these sought a religious, medical, or administrative exemption. They just said, I'm not going to do it. Even the chaplain himself, who had put in for a religious exemption, he was declined. And so they're being removed. So there's that. As I promised, I would keep you up to date on these developments. 888-914-9149. How about Mary in Huntington Beach, California? Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing well, thank you.
Good. I had a question. I'm older, so I don't know if this is true or something I imagined, but I heard that you need to support your parish that you should be in geographically, even if you don't go there.
Well, not exactly. So it used to be in the church's law that you were obligated to attend or at least be registered at and support the parish within whose boundaries you lived. And all the parishes have boundaries, and so that was the church's law at one time. That has been changed, and so now you are free to attend any parish you want. You don't have to go to your territorial parish. You're free to register at a parish, 10 miles away, 100 miles away if you want to do that. So that obligation is no longer in place. But there is the provision in the church's precepts that you do have to in some way, support your local parish, whatever way that's feasible for you to do. So we do have the obligation to support our parishes, but you can attend and register at a parish that's not the one that you live within its boundaries.
Okay. So when you say support, do you mean monetarily or any other way?
Well, it certainly for most people is monetarily. So if you can help with the financial needs of the church, that's something that we're all obliged to do to the extent that we can. Some can do more. But there are some who can't do that at all. So if you can support your parish through prayer, through participation, volunteering, there are other ways to support the parish. But I would say the vast majority of people, the first line of being able to do that would be their donations that they give to the church each week.
Which I do. Mm-hmm. However, I'm not able to double that.
Well, that's a different story. You're not obligated to give any particular amount. The church doesn't require tithing, for example. I know there are some priests who really push tithing as a principle, but that's not something that the church itself requires. The church just simply says to contribute to the needs of the local church. And as I say, for most people, it's going to take the form of making a donation each week or each month But how much that winds up being, that's up to you.
And I do have some activities associated with this parish, which I hopefully will continue.
Yeah, that's a good thing. So in addition to your financial giving to participate, maybe you can volunteer to help teach CCD, or there are any number of things that you can do. That's always a great way to augment whatever financial support you give your parish. Well, thank you, Mary. I appreciate the phone call. Let's go now to Elizabeth in Chicago. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. I just got a new job, and I am an assistant editor for an online journal that deals with medicine and the humanities, and I'm concerned about what my role, like in cooperating with something morally wrong, would be. Where if someone submits an article to the journal, I would have to pass it off to my boss. He would determine if it's rejected or if it goes for further editing. I would probably do some editing and also publish it on the website. And if someone submits something that talks about, oh, abortion's great or something like that, I'm concerned about what I would do and like what my moral responsibility would be there.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a couple questions, Elizabeth. And by the way, I admire you for having a fully functioning conscience that's saying to you, hey, check this out. Let's find out if there's something wrong here. A lot of people don't bother to do that. So my admiration for you. So a couple questions. Number one, is this like a peer-reviewed medical journal where there are varying opinions that are being published for the sake of critique and peer review? Is it something like that?
There's a lot of review of like they'll evaluate different like works of art that have to do with medicine. It's kind of like a potpourri of a lot of different things. There are some differing opinions that I've noticed in the archives, but I know it leans liberal a bit.
Okay. So based upon what you're saying, if you're in an editorial position and you have some say in vetting these inbound articles that are submitted for publication, and let's say somebody submits an article that is in favor of abortion, okay, and you say, well, we'll let this one get published. I don't think that you're doing anything immoral there, because you're in the capacity of bringing this information to the fore for people to evaluate, to, you know, especially to the extent there's any, you know, scientific peer review that takes place. That's the nature of a publication like that. You get this stuff out there so that it can be ripped to shreds if there's something wrong with it. So in that sense, you're not cooperating in something that's evil because you're publishing something that may be favorable to abortion, because the purpose of publishing it is for people to object to it if there's something wrong with it. And I realize this is a kind of subtle thing. And let me give you a parallel example, or a near parallel. Yesterday or the day before, it was the day before yesterday, I shared on this program an article written by a man extolling abortion and how abortion is something he really likes and how he thinks it's a good thing because men benefit from it. So there we have an example of somebody who's promoting abortion, and I shared that article with this audience, not for the purpose of you know, agreeing with him, but for the purpose of pointing out what I deem to be errors in his way of looking at it. So there are circumstances, and yours may well be one of them, where the purpose for disseminating this information is not to promote something that's evil, but to subject it to critique. And that may be, if that's what's going on in your case, that may be why you would not be doing anything inherently immoral.
It seems like it's kind of literary in a sense. Like, it talks about, like, there's a classic book series, and there's something like the weather in relation to the health of the characters or something like that. Okay. But then you also have like people giving their own experiences, their perspectives on things. And it's just a lot going on. And I don't know if it's necessarily like scientific research. It's just like a lot of, it seems like there's a lot of opinions. So I'm not
it's, so it may not be peer reviewed in the sense that I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what about this? What about, let's say you're the editor of a local newspaper and the letters to the editor come in from all different perspectives. And if you've got a person who wrote a letter to the editor who's in favor of Planned Parenthood, if you publish that letter to the editor in your newspaper, I don't think you're doing anything immoral.
Right.
And I don't know how similar to that scenario what you're in is. But if it's similar, and so a newspaper is not a peer-reviewed journal. Obviously, the purpose of a newspaper is to disseminate information and opinions. But I don't think newspaper editors are doing something immoral if they publish a letter to the editor from somebody who takes a position that they don't agree with.
Right.
But, again, I mean, you have to follow your conscience. And if your conscience is bothering you, you know, think more closely about this, analyze it. I'm giving you advice off the cuff without knowing much more than what you've told me. So, but as it stands, based upon what you've said, I don't see a clear case for you saying, well, I can't do this. Now, one thing you could do is you could say to the editor who makes the final decision, I personally don't think this is a good article, or I personally think this is misinformation, or I personally don't think you should publish this. But if you're not the one who's making the ultimate decision, then you've done your part. You've fulfilled your moral obligation to express opposition to something. And if the newspaper editor decides to publish it anyway, that's a different story. Well, magazine editor. But you see what I'm saying, right?
Right. And if I'm the one who's supposed to work on it, even though I don't feel comfortable working on it, my plan was just to tell them that. And see what happens, but...
Yeah, tell them that. And they may say, oh, okay, I get it. Okay, no problem. If it's an article that you don't feel comfortable working on, we'll assign it to somebody else. They may, you know, they may play ball with you, and that would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good stuff, Elizabeth. I'm glad that you're really focusing on some of these important issues. Thank you for that. I'll be right back. You have a special place in God's plan for the world. Learning about Christ's role in history can change your life and strengthen your faith. Right now, get free access to Christendom College's online history class at principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Happy Advent as we prepare for Christmas. A couple quick things before we go back to the telephones. The number to dial, by the way, is 888-914-9149. Bloomberg's got a story, just the sign of the times. A U.S. married couple households with children falls to a record low. The number of U.S. homes with a married couple and children fell to a record low, according to new government data. The share of the U.S.'s 130 million households headed by married parents and children under the age of 18 fell to just 17.8% this year, and that's down from 18.6% last year, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. And that's down more than 40% since 1970. So just to put that into perspective, only less than 18% now of the 130 million households have two parents, mom and dad, married to each other, with children under the age of 18. It was 40% higher some 50 years ago. By absolute numbers, there are just 23.1 million homes with nuclear families, the fewest since 1959. Births have generally been on the decline as Americans are marrying later in life, which has grown more pronounced in the pandemic. The U.S. fertility rates fell to 55.4 births per 1,000 in the second quarter, and that is below replacement level, which is what keeps the population steady. China, Russia, Japan, and a number of countries in Europe are right on the cusp of having an implosion of their populations. This is why China is frantically trying to get couples to have children, because even though they've got well over a billion people, their population is poised to implode. Japan's is already imploding. Now, another story completely unrelated to that, but it is worthy of your attention. A California deputy was sentenced on Wednesday for throwing away a urine test that proved a detained driver wasn't on drugs. So this ex-California deputy was sentenced for throwing out a urine test that exonerated the person who had been arrested. This was before trying to have her jailed on suspicion that she was high on methamphetamine. Richard Charles Barrios III, 29 years old, an ex-deputy with the Ventura County Sheriff's Office, will spend a year behind bars, according to prosecutors. He pleaded guilty to destroying physical matter. The bizarre chain of events unfolded after Barrios pulled over the driver for a traffic violation and suspected that she was on meth. This, according to the Ventura County District Attorney's Office. The deputy who arrived at the scene also believed the driver was high and she was arrested for being under the influence of a controlled substance. Throughout the ordeal, the woman vehemently denied that she was intoxicated, and Barrios promised to free her if the drug test came back negative. The woman supplied the deputy with a urine sample. He was caught on surveillance footage at the police station testing the sample and viewing the results and then tossing it into the trash. The deputy refused to reveal the test results to the woman and tried to have her booked into jail, but she complained to another deputy who found the discarded sample in the garbage. The kit showed that the woman's urine sample was negative for all controlled substances. She agreed to another test, which yielded the same results. So the deputies released the woman and arrested Barrios. Now, it gives me no pleasure to mention a story like this because I have very high regard for law enforcement. I'm very supportive of law enforcement, and it's these outliers that bring attention to this issue where just because somebody is charged with a crime doesn't mean that it's necessarily true. And it's worth our time to be aware that, you know, every so often you get one of these situations where evidence is eliminated or it's falsified. I hate to say it, but it does happen. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Albert in Merrillville, Indiana. Hi, Albert.
Hey, Patrick. Good morning. Okay, I know that a Catholic can marry out of the faith with a person from another religion with a dispensation, but can a Catholic marry an atheist who has never had any religion in her life, never been baptized or anything?
Yes. Again, it would require a dispensation from the bishop, but it can be granted. I would say it's not a smart idea to do that, and the likelihood of difficulty in marriage goes way, way, way up if you can't even agree that God exists. But strictly speaking, the church does see situations where it could grant a dispensation for that. It's not advisable, but it could happen.
Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah, it's not for me. It was, you know, somebody else, a friend, but yeah. I just wanted to be clear on that.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Yeah. And just to expand on that for a moment, the reason that it would be very risky would be because a couple things. Like, so how does a married couple share everything if they can't even share in a mutual belief that God exists? And also, what about the children? Here's where a really severe difficulty is likely to arise, because the Catholic still has the obligation to get married before a Catholic priest or a deacon. So that still is in place. So the Catholic would still have that obligation. And in the vows that are pronounced, I mean, the non-Catholic party would have to agree to raise the children Catholic. So if an atheist really believes that atheism is true, it's going to be weird for that atheist person to say that he or she would agree to raise the children in a belief system that they don't believe is real. So my advice for whoever's listening right now that might be in a similar situation as that last caller would be look for a spouse who is going to share your religious beliefs. This is not to look down on anybody or to say that, you know, somebody is subpar or anything like that. It just introduces a nearly impossible hurdle into the marriage that will inevitably, I think, create all kinds of friction and problems. Perhaps the Catholic Party will get weary of it and wind up leaving the church. The question about the children, what will happen to them? How will they be raised in terms of the faith or no faith? These are all very real dangers and concerns that the church has. So for her part, she strongly admonishes, or not admonishes, she strongly exhorts Catholic folk not to do this for the reasons I just mentioned. So anyway, food for thought. Let's go now to Rhonda in Dubuque. Good morning, Rhonda.
Good morning. I am at the doctor's office right now, and the lady just weighed me and everything, so bear with me while I... Okay, we're in here. I wanted to, on this morning, you had made a comment about a gentleman going down to be helping out with... well, so I went in and Googled his name. I'm from Iowa. He's from Iowa.
You know what, Rhonda? Your phone's acting up. I don't know what's going on. Could you hold for a minute? Somebody will pick up with you and see if we can't get that, because I'm only getting every other word that you're saying. So stand by. We'll get somebody to pick up with you. Thank you. Let's go to Elizabeth now in New York. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi. I have a question about people being present in at adoration.
Okay.
We're having trouble getting people who have signed up to actually show up. The request for subs is on an app, and it's unending. And then that's at the Perpetual Adoration Chapel. And then at our parish, we try to have it on Mondays, and the deacon goes at different times, and there aren't people there. And so he called the pastor. The pastor said that that's no longer a regulation, that people have to be there. I don't know whether that's particular to us or whether the church has really changed that. That's my question.
All right. I don't know either. I would need to do a little bit of work on the usccb.org website, and that's the U.S. Bishops Conference website, in which things like this would be found. So my suggestion would be go to usccb.org, and in the search bar in the upper right, type in Eucharistic Adoration. And you may have to scroll a few times, but if there is a change in the church's, it's not a doctrine, obviously, it's a custom. And there may be something in the church's canon law that pertains to this. I'm not a canon lawyer, so I don't know off the top of my head. But there may be some legal provision on this issue. But one way or the other, you'll find it there. And the church's longstanding custom has been that if there's nobody there to adore the Lord in the Blessed Sacrament, when the Blessed Sacrament is exposed in a monstrance, then the Blessed Sacrament should not be exposed. We don't want the Lord there with an empty room, if at all possible. So the effort is always made to make sure that people will be there so that the Lord is not exposed in the Blessed Sacrament or exposed in the monstrance with nobody there. So I would check out usccb.org and see what you find.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. I'm just wondering before you go, I mean, has the parish done everything it possibly can to make sure that there are people who are there? Because usually when people find out that there are gaps in the, you know, in the hours and when there's nobody who's assigned, there are people who will step forward even at 2 or 3 in the morning to take a shift like that that nobody wants. There are people who will do that. I would say the parish should do everything it can first before it decides to shut down Eucharistic Adoration. Thanks, Elizabeth. All right, hour 3 is here. We'll be doing that in just a minute. I'm going to share with you a very interesting reflection by Monsignor Charles Pope on why was Jesus born, when and where he was born. You ever thought about that? I'll share that with you on the other side right after this.